I don't know if you saw the 85 Super Mario Brothers that we had on the platform.
I sure did.
When we offered that in August 2020, we offered it for $150,000. And that was kind of infancy or beginning of the real kind of sealed video game spike. $150,000 in August 2020, you know, 11 and a half months later, a collector came through and offered $2 million for it. Right. So that was a 1200% return for investors in 11 and a half months. So you bought a $50 share in the IPO and you held it. It paid out, I think, just over $660.
What's going on, everybody? And welcome to Collector's Gene Radio. This is all about diving into the nuances of collecting and ultimately finding out whether or not our guests have what we like to call the collector's gene. If you have the time, please subscribe and leave a review. It truly helps. Thanks a bunch for listening, and please enjoy today's guest on Collector's Gene Radio. Today's guest is Rory Tate, one of the earliest employees at the company Rally. Rally is revolutionizing the way people invest in collectible assets, offering a platform where investors can buy and sell equity shares in items ranging from classic cars, rare books, and even dinosaur skulls. While all of those items seem terribly expensive to collect, that's where Rally takes the wheel. Everyday investors like you and I are able to go onto Rally's platform and buy and sell shares of all of these collectible items that they acquire. For example, in August of 2020, Rally IPO'd a 1985 sealed copy of Super Mario Bros. For Nintendo for $150,000 at $50 a share. Just a year later, the asset was acquired for $2 million, giving their investors a more than 1,200% return on their investment. So even if you bought just one share at $50, your investment would have gone to just under $667. Now, that's only one side to the collecting journey, but what I really love that Rally is doing is that they are preserving the nostalgia of these items through stories and their in-person museum in New York, where you can visit these items to see them for yourself. And I urge you all to do so. The content on today's episode is for informational purposes only, and you should not construe any such information or other material as legal, tax, investment, financial, or other advice. Without further ado, this is Rory Tate for Collector's Gene Radio. Rory, welcome to Collector's Gene Radio.
And thanks for having me, Cameron. Really excited to be here.
My pleasure. I think the last time we spoke, you were fist bumping Richard Branson on his way to his space launch. And I messaged you and I was like, what are you doing there?
Yeah, that was a couple of years back, but a crazy, crazy day. And it was really fun to watch. Pretty historical moment.
No doubt. All right. So you were an early employee at Rally, which is a platform for everyday people like me to invest in collectible assets. Tell me how Rally got started and how you got involved and where you guys are at today.
Yeah. So for people that don't know about Rally, the idea is essentially we could take any collectible, run it through an SEC process, a Reg A plus process, and turn that individual collectible into a company that can accept investments from accredited and non-accredited investors. So it kind of pioneered this standardized consumer-facing process that removed a lot of the confusion, and intimidation associated with traditional financial transactions. So anything from a vintage car to a Rolex or one of the original copies of the Declaration of Independence, people can invest in the same way they invest in stocks.
Love it.
The idea started, our three co-founders, Chris, Rob, and Max, kind of came from different backgrounds. Chris was in venture capital. Rob did a bunch of different creative jobs. He worked at Good Music and in the music industry and had done a couple different startups. And Max, who's German-born guy, lives in Switzerland now, went to college with Chris and was working in banking in New York. All of them kind of had interest in buying really collectible cars, but couldn't necessarily afford it, thought about going in together on them. And kind of the story that's always told is Chris, who's our CEO and founder or co-founder, wanted to buy a slant-nosed Porsche that was coming up at auctions. And his parents said, don't do that. You live in Manhattan. You're not going to drive it. It's not a good investment. You should buy real estate instead. And I think that was right around 2008. Chris took his parents' advice, bought a house out in Long Island. And, you know, then the 2008 crash came. The house didn't do as well as an investment. Meanwhile, that Porsche came back to auction a couple years later for significantly more money. So he started talking with his buddies from high school and college, and they came together to launch Rally. We started with collectible cars, kind of following the story of the Slant Nose, and we've expanded to, I think, over 23 asset classes since then.
Amazing. How are you guys acquiring these assets? I mean, auctions, private collections?
Yeah, it's really interesting how the acquisitions process has changed kind of since we launched. I think with each different asset class, it kind of starts the same way, where we go into a new asset class, let's say, sports cards, right? When you first enter kind of a new market, there's new auction houses, there's new, you know, people involved and personalities involved. So when we first kind of come into a new space, it's always, you know, bringing on strategic advisors, having the communications with kind of the introductions with the leaders in the space. And typically at the beginning, it's going, you know, to auctions or cars, like big dealerships, and acquiring those assets from them based on what we're looking for. I think as we kind of build a name for ourselves in the space and have done a bunch of, you know, IPOs for that asset class and onboard people that are, you know, coming to the platform because that's the asset class they're interested in, the acquisition process shifts somewhat, where it's we're still going to those dealers and auctions and finding assets that are on our list, but also suddenly you start, you know, having people come to us. So whether it's a user who, you know, has a collection of their own, you know, or a user knows somebody that has a special asset, those start coming to us as, you know, hey, I'd love to see this on the platform, or hey, I know about this asset that might be on your list. Are you guys interested in that? So, you know, once an asset class is kind of in motion, we acquire things various different ways, whether it's going out and purchasing it, or it's coming to us kind of organically through the user base. There's always, you know, a list of things that we're really, really looking for, and a list of things that we're actively hunting. But a lot of interesting assets have come to us organically that we've then kind of done the research on and found a history of appreciation and an incredible story behind it that really fits what we're looking for and ends up being, you know, an IPO'd asset on the platform.
Do you notice that collectors on the platform are spreading their portfolios across all types of collectible assets, or are the car folks sticking to cars and the art folks are sticking to art?
You end up seeing a lot of kind of cross-pollination between different asset classes. And I think the reason being is, as a company, you know, we're acquiring these assets, presenting them, telling the story, and showing kind of this history of appreciation. So we, in a way, have become kind of these curators, right? We're curating what's going on the platform. And it's assumed and believed and trusted that, you know, we're not going to put anything on there to the best of our ability that is not a good investment, right? So when we bring something new, for instance, like, you know, we launched books, right? When we went out and started doing books, it was, here are the three books that you guys should really start with, you know, a Shakespeare fourth folio, or just kind of antiquated titles that are really great investments. But for us, it was, you know, the first book we launched with in the book category was a first edition Harry Potter Philosopher's Stone.
Right. Something relatable to kind of everybody.
Exactly. And, you know, within the age group of our investors, right? So if someone's investing in a sports card from the 80s or 90s, you know, they're growing up at a time where they know Harry Potter and they've seen the growth of that, you know, franchise. So when we present something new, you end up seeing people, oh, you know, Rally has it on the platform. I know this title. I know how big this is. This is, you know, one of 200 copies that were printed with, you know, the mistaken title on the rear cover, which led to the birth of this huge franchise. Like, that makes a lot of sense as an investment. Yeah, I'll test it out. And, you know, someone will test out that new asset class. And as we add more assets in that vertical, you know, if they relate to it, they make sense. So there's a lot of cross-pollination.
I would have to imagine, yeah. I mean, as a collector myself, and, you know, chatting with people like you on the podcast, it's gotten me into so many different areas of collecting, just being exposed to all this stuff, right? So I would have to imagine that, you know, people on the platform are getting excited about books when they were strictly a car collector, and they're getting excited about art and wine and all that sort of stuff.
100%. It's in working at the company too, where I'm, you know, have been exposed to a lot of this stuff over the years.
Yeah, that's got to be tough.
It's almost a disease, right? Because,
yeah,
you know, we'll go, oh, you know, let's do Birkin bags. I know, or I knew nothing about Birkin bags. But as soon as you start kind of researching the space and learning about it, suddenly, like, I love Birkin bags. I think they're a fantastic investment. I'm not never going to carry a purse, or especially a $100,000 purse around Manhattan. but I want one like badly. It's like sticking under your bed.
Yeah, there's a pretty cool Birkin bag that they did that was, I think, targeted maybe a little bit more towards the male market, but it was like this rugged Birkin that had, it was more like a travel style bag that had like pockets on the outside and a spot for like a canteen and all this stuff. It was pretty cool. You'll have to check it out.
There's some crazy ones, and each one has a wild story. And I mean, the story of the Birkin bag in general is an awesome story, but it's such a wild space where, you know, it's kind of unlike any other asset class, the way you get access to them, the way you purchase them, the way that they're used or, you know, not used in most cases. It's fascinating, and you come to kind of love and respect the story and the space, even if it's not something that you ever thought you would.
Yeah, there's very few brands where every single item that they produce and have produced over time is collectible, right? You get that with Hermes, and there's very few brands that are like that. I mean, Tiffany doesn't even fall into that category, you know, because you can walk into a store and buy rare Tiffany items that aren't necessarily cheap, but you can buy them. And there's so much stuff that Hermes has done from past to present that is so collectible across so many different categories that very few people have done it. It's definitely a great collecting market.
Exactly. And there's like a different level too that exists with it. I think Tiffany's is a perfect example, but you know, Tiffany's has the, you can buy it, you can go in, walk in and buy something, and it's, you know, going to be, it's going to retain its value. It's a beautiful item. But then like similar to Hermes, there's a kind of a different level where you can't just go into Tiffany's and get a Tiffany stamp Patek or a Tiffany stamp Rolex. It's like the Birkin bag, where you have to kind of go in and buy a bunch of stuff over years and build a relationship to get access to these things. And that's where the really special, really crazy stuff comes. It truly breeds this disease of, you know, I got to get all of this stuff and collect it to get access to the thing I want.
Right.
But it's an incredible system they've built, but it works and it makes these items incredibly special and rare.
How are you guys tracking the market to determine how these assets go up or down, especially, right, since the shares are traded on your platform and not necessarily a general stock market?
Yeah, so we're in the acquisition stage of things, we're tracking prices and public sales, right? So it's analysis on comps or comparable assets as long back as we can find them. And kind of tracking the market that way. Similarly, on the exit side, you know, when someone makes an offer on something, we have to do the same thing with public market comps. But when something is on the platform itself, the price or the market cap of that asset is set by the trading. So, you know, if you purchase shares at $10 and your people are selling shares at $12, the market cap multiplies by that $12 and is set by what those shares are trading on the platform for. So I think the ultimate goal, and in some asset classes we've gotten there, some, you know, we need to build up the volume and bring more assets to it, but the ultimate goal of Rally is to have our market cap and the market cap on the platform be more accurate than, you know, what an auction expectation is, right? An asset might come to auction, especially rare assets, might come to auction every year or every couple of years, and that price is set by the result. But our prices and the prices for these assets on our platform are reset 5 days a week by the investors, right? So it's a fascinating way to kind of see where investor sentiment is, where interest is, how people are reacting to different comps. You know, if a very rare card trades incredibly above kind of what the expected was, does that affect other cards in the, you know, in that similar sport? And that's what we get to watch 5 days a week with trading on the platform.
I would have to imagine that most of the team at Rally are collectors of sort. Does this make it easier, would you say, when sourcing items for the platform to have that kind of mindset as a collector?
I think everyone at the company comes in with kind of their background of, you know, I'm a collector in this asset class. And you see kind of different people get drawn into different asset classes once they join the company that they become, you know, obsessed with or they want to collect. Personally, it's difficult because there's some items that I'd love to be, you know, show great comps and a great history of appreciation because I've always loved those items. I'd love to get them on the platform. I'd love to own them myself someday. But when you dig into the numbers, sometimes it's like, oh, you know, this doesn't, it doesn't fit our investment criteria or kind of underwriting standards. And then you start considering, oh, like, should that not be on my personal list one day? Like, is this something I shouldn't invest in? And it's
the mental rabbit hole.
Yeah, it's like a ripple effect through your dreams. If it doesn't fit the platform, should it fit my list? But yeah, and you also have the opposite effect, right? There's some assets that you maybe didn't know about, or you hadn't done the research on, or known the story about, or seen kind of the history of the transactions around it, that suddenly once you learn more about it and see it, you become obsessed over something you never thought you would be. And I think there's a looking for something for the platform, and there's something that's on, like, you know, your personal bucket list. And I think if, or at least personally, when I've found something that is on my bucket list that has, you know, the background to be a fit for the platform and kind of the history of appreciation, then it's like, it is underlined on my bucket list.
So Rally has over 450 assets on the platform. Are there certain trends where you see people hold in certain categories and sell and trade in others, right? Like, are the Porsche guys holding on to shares of their vintage Porsche through Rally versus, you know, we're obviously seeing some fluctuation in the modern watch world, right? So are you seeing more people sell and trade in those areas?
The thing is, with each of these assets, they're their own company, right? So each one has its own market cap, its own number of shares, its own number of investors. And it's not necessarily the same across a category for cars, right? So on an individual basis, you'll see things like our Declaration of Independence, right? It's one of about 20 privately owned examples from July 1776. It's a broadside copy. Ours was printed in, you know, for Exeter, New Hampshire, to get word out about like, you know, the Declaration of Independence. Pre-email, we post this up on a government building. You read it, you know what's going on. That asset, you know, shares trade and the float, you know, turns over, I think, close to, you know, fully once a year. And I, you know, I don't know the exact number right now, but that float is changing hands a lot. You're not seeing the same amount of transactions around something like Yoko Ono's first edition grapefruit book from 1960s, right? It's an incredible asset. It has this insane story, but there's less comps or there's less excitement around that asset. So people who really know about those assets are holding it long term. And then you get some assets that are exciting or have a lot of comps coming up where people are kind of flipping shares quickly to make money when they can on it. Cars for us have been on the platform the longest period of time. And I think, you know, it's typically our larger investors are in cars, our longer hold times are in cars. But recently we've been doing a lot of exits in cars on the platform. So you see a lot more transactions on other cars kind of in this space. So it varies both based on kind of what's going on in the broader category on the platform and also what the asset is, right? There's no kind of overarching answer that is true for everything.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, every situation is obviously going to be different, and timing of certain markets are different, and auction seasons help or don't help. And
exactly.
Do you guys sit on the assets until you find there's a good opportunity to sell, or do you strictly hold them?
Everything on the platform is kind of always for sale, right? So once it IPOs, there's always a button at the bottom of the main page for the asset that says, you know, if you're interested in buying it, you know, reach out to us here. And we get a lot of offers that way. You know, if an offer comes in on an asset, there's a couple ways it happens, right? Sometimes we'll get an offer that comes in through the app that's, you know, at or above fair market value, represents good returns for the investors. And that's great. So what we do is we take that number. We make sure that it's a real offer. We, you know, check that the money's there, get kind of proof of funds, but then we'll pull the investors. And if the majority of investors say, yeah, I want to take this offer at this price, the asset's sold to that person and everyone's paid out on a share weighted basis. There's also cases, which we've run maybe about a dozen in the past 2 months, where there's been some comps that have come out around an asset and the asset's not trading, you know, where those comps have been, where we'll pull the investors and say, hey, do you, you know, there's this auction coming up, which fits kind of this asset for these criteria. Do you want to send the asset to auction? And if the majority of investors vote in favor of that, you know, we'll send it that way. We're always actively speaking with auction houses and private collectors and people in network to find, you know, exit opportunities for these assets, but it also comes kind of organically through the app sometimes, which is awesome.
That's pretty cool. So it just has to be the majority of the investors to say yay or nay to potentially move an item.
Exactly. It's the majority. It's typically it's majority of individual investors and majority of shares. So if both are in favor, it is sold or sent to auction to be sold.
How do you balance the emotional attachment a lot of these collectors have to the items, right? With the financial aspect of investing, you reach out to them and say, hey, we have an offer on this. We think it's a great offer. Does majority want to sell? And then you probably have some pushback from the guys that are like, no, I want to hold. Like, I really feel like I own a piece of this thing and I'm not ready to sell. But sometimes they don't have an option.
I think one of the considerations that we have when we're kind of deciding whether we pull on something is, you know, if the offer is, let's say, at fair market value, kind of one of the pieces we measure is this something that we could replace at or around this price in the future, right? If it's a one of one item, let's say like we had a court, three pieces of the court from Kobe Bryant's final game at the Staples Center. You know, he dropped 60 points. They had both of his numbers on the court. He signed the court on his number. We had, you know, that number with his signature. When an offer came in for that asset, if the offer was right about where we bought it or was, you know, around fair market value, we could never replace that asset, right? So basically, we wait for those things to get really strong offers that give investors really great returns. At the end of the day, it's a financial platform where, you know, you're making investments based off of things that you know and collect and, you know, hold dear that you might not be able to buy yourself. But it's a platform to diversify your investments and make money. So some of the exits we have hurt because I love seeing them in our museum, or I love, you know, having them on display at a show. But at the end of the day, it's if the returns are strong and, you know, they're at or above fair market value for that asset at the time, it's, you know, our kind of responsibility to present it to investors. And if the majority are in favor, the majority are in favor.
Do you have to present all offers that come in?
Yes. We feel responsible to present all offers that are at or above the fair market value. Like we'll have offers come in, you know, for a $100,000 card at $60,000. That's not an offer that's going to get passed. That's not an offer that reflects the value. You know, we won't run an offer like that. But if it's within that kind of fair market value and the person has the proof of funds to do it, we'll present those offers. Yes.
In general, what intrinsic value do you believe that collectibles hold beyond their monetary worth? And, you know, how does Rally strive to preserve and celebrate this aspect of collecting beyond the financials?
Have you been to our museum in Manhattan or no?
I haven't. It's on my list of things to do next time I come in.
We've got to get you into the museum. But the idea of the museum, right, the kind of catchphrase for it is the only museum where you can own everything inside. And it's built around nostalgia, right? So I grew up in a family where my uncle and my grandfather were huge collectors, right? And my uncle at a very young age kind of told me about this thing called poster theory, right? So if you have a poster on your wall when you're a kid, when you kind of get to your peak income level or peak wealth point, which is call it your 40s, 50s, 60s, and you have that disposable income, you want to buy the best possible example of that thing you dreamt of as a child. Right. So if you were born in the 80s and you had a Countach on your wall, when you're in your 40s, 50s, 60s, like that's the car you want and you want the best possible one. I think a lot of the assets on the platform, right, have incredible either historical or artistic history to them. Right. So the Declaration of Independence is, you know, one of our assets that is obviously extremely important to U.S. history. And that asset is something that's been sold privately before. It's something that could ultimately end up, you know, in a private collection or in someone's house. But bringing it on the platform, presenting it to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that have suddenly this opportunity to own a share of it, or, you know, own a share and come see it in person in the museum and you know, really be connected to it and own it. Having those assets available to the masses and making sure that they're celebrated and, you know, shown is extremely important. You know, we have a dinosaur in the museum right now that's, I think, between 55 and 60 million years old.
Unbelievable.
It's a crazy, crazy piece. But
when we were going through the acquisition process, the seller was kind of deciding, do I want to sell this to Jeff Bezos or do we want to put it on Rally? And ultimately he chose Rally because, you know, you get a billionaire buying something like that, it disappears. It sits on their, you know, yacht or in their living room. Right. But there's something important about letting anybody, you know, see it and being able to tell them the story and let them become owners in it. That kind of gives these assets or allows them to have a continued life beyond just sitting in a storage facility or a private collection somewhere and never seeing the light of day.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the benefit that Rally offers the customers, right? It's like this is intangible value that people get, right? Even if you're not a user on the Rally platform, you can go to the museum and you can look at all these items. You can really study them and enjoy them as if you were going to a museum. And I feel like that's like the biggest benefit that Rally can offer to everybody who's interested in any sort of collectible item is go on the website, go to the museum. You can see these items. You can learn about them. You know exactly where they are, right?
Exactly. And the goal has always been to have something or a bunch of things for everyone, right? So as we continue to expand asset classes, we continue to kind of go into more spaces, it kind of continues to grow this community of people who have always, you know, wanted to collect or wanted to buy these super rare and expensive assets, but don't necessarily have the means to, right? Not many have the ability to buy a $300,000 Birkin bag and hide it away, but suddenly you can, right? And you can come see it. And there's something special about owning it, right? Like I own a piece of that and it makes the connection real, and seeing it in person or in the museum, you really connect deeply with the story of that asset in a way that you wouldn't if you saw it sitting in a store window, for instance.
Yeah. And I mean, you can fill that void of nostalgia that people have earlier than maybe they're expecting, right? If you know, a 25-year-old doesn't necessarily have the means to buy his Countach that was on his wall or his Lamborghini Diablo that was on his wall growing up, right? He can have a piece of that now and then eventually still aspire to own one in full one day. But, you know, maybe if the values go up enough and you guys sell, he could potentially own one on a nice swing.
But that's the point, right? And I think the company was built by those types of people, right? We all want to own those assets one day. We all dream of owning those assets or have dreamed of owning those assets. And it's not something that's feasible, right? At certain ages. So we might, you know, I personally might know more about various Porsche 911 models than a guy who has a collection of 50 of them, let's say, but I can't go buy 50 of them. But I know that buying, you know, these cars in specific versions offer incredible returns. So not only will it be harder for me to buy it in 10 years or 20 years from now, I can't participate in the upside or the appreciation of the things that I know will appreciate and truly care about, you know, let's say more than Apple's P/E ratio, right?
Right.
So it was built for that group of people by that group of people in a way.
Let's just hope that Bezos comes and offers Rally something ridiculous for that dinosaur. You could pass that off to the investors, right?
Yeah, Jeff, if you're listening, it's always for sale.
There's always a price, right?
There's always a price. And you know, there's crazy stuff that happened. We had I don't know if you saw the 85 Super Mario Brothers that we had on the platform.
I sure did.
When we offered that in August 2020, we offered it for $150,000. And that was kind of infancy or beginning of the real kind of sealed video game spike. $150,000 in August 2020, you know, 11 and a half months later, a collector came through and offered $2 million for it, right? So that was a 1,200% return for investors in 11 and a half months. So you bought a $50 share in the IPO and you held it. It paid out, I think, just over $660. You
can't
get a couple,
it's
a great move. You get a couple of those and suddenly, you know, take that money and go buy a you know, slightly lower grade version of it. You can start to, you know, turn it into owning it outright.
Any fun stories you can share in regards to the acquisition of a specific item you guys have IPO'd?
Actually, yeah, I have a fun one. One of the assets we have actually in the museum right now is all six of the Chicago Bulls championship rings.
Oh, wow.
which one, there were not many players who were there for all 6 years and got all six rings. But there's also a difference between player rings and staff rings, right? Like everyone in the organization who works for the Bulls would get a ring, but only certain, you know, owners or GMs or high ranking people in the organization would get the actual kind of diamond set ring aside from the players. We have all six rings from a guy named John Capps, who was a security guard for the Bulls, but also Jordan. I don't know if you watched The Last Dance, but they covered kind of his relationship with the different security guards on the team. And I think after Jordan's father died, you know, Capps kind of fulfilled a father figure role for Jordan. And Jordan, I believe, paid his salary through his death.
Unbelievable.
But after he died, John Capps' rings came up to auction at a relatively small auction house. We got word of that through one of kind of our strategic advisors in the space, and we wanted to buy them. But the difficult part of it was all six of them, each one was a separate lot, right? So they
that's interesting.
Which was fascinating, and I don't know if it was beneficial to them in any way. You know, I don't know if it made sense, I think, as a lot. Having all six, and John Capps' rings are diamond set, you know, player issue diamond set rings. They're not the typical employee rings, but they sold them as six different lots. So, you know, we went into that auction, we're prepping for that auction, you know, terrified that if someone noticed that the winning bidder on five of the rings had been the same person, they'd just run up the price of the sixth. So
not only that, but like if you only win two or three of the six, I mean, it kind of changes the value in an odd way because you guys are going for the whole set.
100%. Like I don't, you know, if we'd only gotten two or three of them, I don't know if we would have offered it, right? Like we would have had right. to probably exit those three in some way, shape or form. So kind of prepping and going into the auction, we had different kind of people in our advisory, you know, board and group and network prepped to bid on different rings from different locations and different accounts. And we ended up getting all six of them. Yeah, it was it's one of my favorite assets on the platform. It's incredible. And I don't know if you've ever seen the picture. I think it was a Nike ad of Jordan kind of posing with all six of his rings on.
Sure.
Kind of holding his face with them. But having all six of them sitting next to each other is like this crazy thing. There's so few people that were there all 6 years. So it worked in the end, ultimately, but that was a terrifying and I think very, you know, sweaty-handed bidding process as we went through all six lots.
I'm sure. I mean, you guys went about it the right way, though, of creating separate bidding accounts and all that sort of stuff, because there is a lot of psychology behind that and people watching. And
exactly. If I had noticed, I would have been tempted to kind of run up the sixth myself, you know?
100%. Why not?
Why not?
Speaking of rally, let's talk about the rally that you put on every year during the weekend of the bridge.
Yeah. Myself and the rally team plus Hootie. Hootie is a good friend of mine and the company's, and you know, we would go to the bridge every year. And for, I guess, people that aren't familiar with the bridge, it's this incredible show put on by Jeff Einhorn and Shereen Abbas and at the bridge, which is a golf course in Bridgehampton that used to be the Bridgehampton racetrack. So they fill the course with kind of the most incredible cars in the world. And it's made for photography almost. It's perfect. It's beautiful. We'd go every year and kind of, you know, chat about the fact that there's so many owners of these incredible cars that don't even necessarily show them themselves, right? They have a collection manager or they have a group that manages the cars who brings it, puts it on the course, puts it back in the truck and drives it back to a storage facility. And that, I think Hootie and I both felt that it's kind of this sad thing, right? Like, both of us dream of owning, you know, these incredible cars one day. I couldn't imagine saying, you know, I'm not going to go and show this car. I'm not going to go, you know, bring this car to this event and see all these incredible things. I'm just going to send my collection manager to do it. So in 2021, we decided to get a group of people who were showing their cars at the bridge that we knew together the day beforehand. So the bridge is always a Saturday and everyone kind of goes out on Friday. So we decided, you know, Friday morning, we want to get a group of people with, you know, incredible cars and incredibly interesting people together. And we want to get those cars out on the road and drive them. So we called it the 24 Hours Du Mans Talk, kind of a play on 24 Hours Du Mans. And that first year, I think we had 11 cars. And it was awesome. It rained, but, you know, people came out and drove these cars that they were just planning on showing for the weekend and had a great time. So we kind of grew it for the second year, and I think we had around 20, 25 cars. And then for the third year, this past year, we had about 50 cars and just over 100 attendees, right? So one or two people per car, and some really, really spectacular people and collectors showed up. Jazz Dylan, who's from Tennessee, kind of incredible collector of Le Mans raced Porsches, showed up in his, you know, somewhat, I don't know the truth behind it, but he has this road legal Le Mans car.
unheard of.
Like you don't see those cars on the streets, right? So getting Jazz out, you know, with his crazy noise canceling headphones on in a Le Mans car and driving it through the Hamptons, you know, in regular traffic and going through stop signs, you know, with a group of 50 other incredible cars is this really awesome thing for people who are driving by and see it. But it's also, I think, incredibly impactful for the people who own it and don't necessarily think of these cars as something they can drive on the streets or enjoy like that. You know, it's so scared. They're scared to do it as an investment or to damage it or just don't want to do it. So the 24-hour Du Mans Talk is continued to grow, and we'll, you know, keep doing it. We'll have another one next year and hopefully get some, you know, continued interesting and fascinating vehicles and people out on the road and try to get people who are showing their spectacular things to come enjoy the event and experience those things, kind of force them to enjoy these assets.
Can't beat it. And, you know, what I love about it is that it's not the most strenuous drive to go from Manhattan or Long Island to the other side of Long Island, you know, and it's a digestible thing for people that are collectors of these rare cars that don't get driven often to hop in them and go for a quick drive.
Exactly. It's not a scary drive. It's not a dangerous drive. It's really easy. We started this year at the Parrish Art Museum and drove, you know, to the tip of Montauk to Dive Bar Pizza, right? So it's right. A short drive. It's a beautiful drive. I mean, the Hamptons, you get everything from vineyards to beaches to golf courses and, you know, beautiful homes. So you get a bunch of different backdrops you're driving in a pretty short period of time. And then you end with a lunch and kind of chatting with like-minded people. So it's a lot of fun. And we're excited to kind of continue to grow it and hone it and make it more interesting in years to come. We'll have to get you out there this year.
Hey, I am 100% down to come in and do that. I'm hopping in your car.
Done. Consider it's an official invite.
Rory, let's wrap it up here with the Collector's Gene Rundown. You can answer these questions based on the things that you love to collect. You could base it off of the things that you guys are acquiring for Rally, however you see fit.
Perfect.
All right. What's the one that got away?
Personally, I had a perfect Porsche 944 that I bought in college that I loved. It was the best example I'd found. And I got a little bored during COVID and tried to build it into a safari car, kind of before 944s were being built into safari cars, and unfortunately wrapped it around a telephone pole.
Oh, geez.
So I'm yearning to get one of those back. I had it in my hands, but that's the one that hurts the most still.
It'll come back. The On Deck Circle. So what's next for you in collecting? Maybe it's something you're hunting besides the safari car.
On Deck right now, I'm going through a really deep obsessive watch phase. I'd really, really love to get kind of a pre-Daytona Rolex. I'm really into kind of the early Rolexes right now.
How about the unobtainable? So this is something that is just too expensive. Maybe it's in a private collection or it's in the Rally Museum and it's just complete unobtainium.
Yeah, that's an easy one for me. we have on the platform, it's not in the museum right now, but it was in the museum for a period of time. We have one of the two twin turbo prototype Lamborghini Countaches built into the 1980s. Ours is this kind of candy apple red with candy apple red wheels and full white interior, period correct, you know, Escort radar system. And it was built essentially to compete with, I believe F40 at the time was faster than the Countach. So they tried to twin turbo it. It was driven through the Swiss Alps and tested and then disappeared for a couple decades. It was discovered by John Tamarian in I believe Reno or Vegas in about 2018. And we put it on the platform pretty quickly after that. But that's a car that, you know, while I don't love driving Countaches, I'm a little, at 6'5", I'm a little tall to fit comfortably in them.
That's not the right cockpit for you.
No, but every time I get, you know, the opportunity to drive that car from the truck onto, you know, let's say the bridge, the golf course at the bridge, it's the dream one day would be to own that car. But unfortunately, there's two of them. And that is pure unobtainium to me.
At least you get to look at it from time to time.
Exactly. I'm incredibly blessed to get to see it often.
The page one rewrite. So if you could collect anything besides cars and watches, money is no object, what would it be?
Through my time at Rally, I've become really fascinated by books. We have some really awesome books on the platform. You know, Shakespeare's Fourth Folio, the first edition Harry Potter, which actually was recently sold. You know, the Great Gatsby with the original dust cover, first edition dust cover. I don't know if I'd be good at collecting books. I don't know, you know, how I'd store, display them personally. You know, in the museum, it's really fun and easy, but money is no object. I think I'd get a beautiful library and fill it with some spectacular books.
Yeah, there's something special about the rare book collecting side of things, especially, you know, very first early editions and early copies of stuff, because you know that that was a touch and feel item for the author to inspect to make sure that it, you know, turned out the correct way. And I think that there's just some sort of, there's something magical about that.
Oh, 100%. Like, for instance, one of the books on the platform that I, you know, is not a title that's necessarily that collectible is we have JFK's Profiles in Courage, right? Which is after I think it was maybe in the run up to the 60s election, right? So 1959, he wrote this book and the one that we have was inscribed by JFK to Frank Sinatra.
Incredible.
And to me, the idea that, you know, the president wrote this book and then signed it, you know, to Frank Sinatra is, you know, both of them touched it. It's kind of this, you get to see this letter that they wrote privately, right? Like, here's a book for you. I hope you enjoy it type thing. That to me is you're touching so many pieces of history, whether it's people or, you know, the book itself, that you really can't beat in with any other asset class.
Yeah, there's something so interesting about that. And you just kind of run your mind across all these different scenarios of how it was gifted and what the scenario was. And yeah, super interesting.
And in the final point, I think this might be controversial, but I think we'll see less and less books, right? Everything's going ebooks and iPads, and they're going to, in my mind, it's going to become harder to get your hands on a, you know, hard-covered book. So
there's already very few of the very rare collectible stuff.
Exactly.
How about the GOAT? So who do you look up to in the collecting world? Who do you think is a fantastic collector?
My grandfather was a big collector, but that's, you know, one answer. But my grandfather was super into watches, and I got a watch that he wore often before he died when I graduated from high school from my grandmother. And it kind of turned me onto watches, and immediately it was an Omega Speedmaster. And my first kind of foray into watches was Hodinkee, right? I read and watched every piece of content that they had put out, like, voraciously. Sure. And Ben and the team at Hodinkee, but Ben in particular, his collection and his ability to kind of curate watch stories or personally for him to curate these incredible watches and his collection. I really enjoy following his collection. and you know, reading about it and reading about why he's choosing certain things or why certain things stand out to him. So he's definitely up there for me.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of cool that you guys share that same sentiment of receiving a Speedmaster as kind of your first foray into watch collecting.
Exactly. That's, I think that was among the first couple of pieces I think that he might have told, I heard that story on his podcast. You know, he's been on this podcast, right?
He has, yes. Yep.
Yeah. But when I heard that story, I'm like, okay, I get it. This is why people like watches. It must be, he must have to get a Speedmaster first. And I think that's when I got really hooked.
It's definitely an important one. Yeah. The hunt or the ownership? Which one do you enjoy more?
My job, or a lot of my job, is the hunt. And I love the hunt. But ultimately, I think my goal is to one day, you know, be the ownership portion. I think right now we get to, you know, give the ownership portion to, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in a way. But, you know, one day I'd like to be able to own some of the incredible things that we hunt down personally.
No doubt. Most importantly, Rory, do you feel that you were born with the collector's gene?
I do. I think my family is all collectors. And from a very early age, it was kind of in my blood. That said, it's a gene. It sometimes also feels like a disease, I think. But
there's a direct correlation between the two.
Oh, 100%. Obsession, gene, disease. Yeah, I do think I have had it in my blood.
Love it, Rory. Thanks so much for joining me today. Hats off to you and the Rally team for everything that you guys have going on. It will be linked up here for everyone to check out the Rally platform and start investing in some cool collectible assets.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that does it for this episode. Thank you all for listening to Collector's Gene Radio.